and he rows his boat out into the ocean every day to fish, not only because he needs to eat, but because he feels peaceful on the water. But more than that, he also wants to improve his life and that of his family, so he works hard at bringing in bigger and bigger catches. With his earnings, he eventually buys a bigger boat so he can make his business even more profitable. That leads to a third boat and then a fourth boat, and as the years pass and the business continues to grow, he eventually accumulates a whole fleet of boats. By then, he's rich and successful with a big house and a thriving business, but the stress and pressure of running the company eventually take their toll. He realizes that when he retires, what he really wants more than anything is to live in a tiny cottage on the beach where he can fish all day in a rowboat, because he wants to feel the same sense of peace and satisfaction he experienced when he was young. She cocked her head. Your mom's a wise woman. There's a lot of truth in that story.
Do you think so?
I think, she said, that the point is that people rarely understand that nothing is ever exactly what you think it will be. By then, they'd reached the entrance to the maze. Luke led her through, pointing out openings that dead-ended after a series of turns, and others that led much farther. The maze covered nearly an acre, which made it a huge draw for kids. When they reached the exit, they strolled toward the harvested pumpkins. While many had been placed up front, some were stacked in bins, others clustered together in loose piles. Hundreds remained in the field beyond.
That's it, he said.
It's a lot. How long did it take you to set all this up?
3 days. But we had other things to do, too.
Of course you did. She sorted through the pumpkins, eventually picking out a medium-sized one and handing it to Luke before they walked back to the truck, where he loaded it into the bed. When he turned, Sophia was standing in front of him, her thick blonde hair almost whitish in the starlight. Instinctively, he reached first for one hand and then the other, and the words came out before he could stop them.
I feel like I want to know everything about you, he murmured.
You know me better than you think, she said. I've told you about my family and childhood. I've told you about college and what I want to do with my life. There's not much else to know.
But there was. There was so much more, and he wanted to know everything. Why are you here? He whispered.
She wasn't sure what he meant.
Because you brought me here?
I mean, why are you with me?
Because I want to be here.
I'm glad,
he said.
Yeah? Why?
Because you're smart and interesting.
Her head was tilted up, her expression inviting. The last time you called me interesting, you ended up kissing me. He said nothing to that. Instead, leaning in, he watched her eyes slowly close, and when their lips came together, he felt a sense of discovery, like an explorer finally reaching distant shores he'd only imagined or heard about. He kissed her again, and then again, and when he pulled back, he rested his forehead against hers. He drew a deep breath, struggling to keep his emotions in check, knowing that he didn't love her simply in the here and now, but that he would never stop loving her.
Ira. It is now Sunday afternoon, and once it gets dark, I will have been here for more than 24 hours. The pain continues to wax and wane, but my legs and feet have gone numb from the cold. My face, where it rests against the steering wheel, has begun to ache. I can feel the bruises forming. My greatest torment, however, has become thirst. The thought of water is excruciating, my throat prickling with each breath. My lips are as dry and cracked as a drought-stricken field. Water, I think again. Without it, I will die. I need it and can hear it calling to me. Water. 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 The thought won't leave me, blocking out everything else. I have never in my life craved such a simple thing, I have never in my life spent hours wondering how to get it. And I do not need much, just a little. Even a capful will make all the difference in the world. A single drop will make a difference. Yet I remain paralyzed. I don't know where the bottle of water is, and I'm not sure I'd be able to open it, even if I could find it. I'm afraid that if I unbuckle the seatbelt, I might topple forward, too weak to stop my collarbone from smashing into the steering wheel. I might end up crumpled on the floor of the car, wedged into a position from which I can't escape. I can't even imagine lifting my head from the steering wheel, let alone rummaging through the car. And still my need for water calls to me. Its call is constant and insistent, and desperation sets in. I am going to die of thirst, I think to myself. I am going to die here as I am. And there is no way I will ever get to the back seat. The paramedics will not slide me out like a fish stick. You have a morbid sense of humor, Ruth says, interrupting my thoughts, and I remind myself that she is nothing but a dream. I think the situation calls for it, don't you?
You are still alive.
Yes, but for how much longer?
The record is 64 days. A man in Sweden. I saw it on the Weather Channel.
No, I saw it on the Weather Channel.
She shrugs. It is the same thing, yes?
She has a point, I think. I need water.
No, she says. Right now we need to talk. It will keep your mind from fixating on it.
Like a trick, I say. I am not a trick, she says. I am your wife, and I want you to listen to me. I obey, staring at her. I allow myself to drift again. My eyes finally close, and I feel as if I'm floating downstream in a river. Images coming and going, one right after the other as I'm carried past on the current. Drifting, drifting. And then, finally, it solidifies into something real. In the car, I open my eyes and blink, noticing how Ruth has changed from my last vision of her. But this memory, unlike the others, is sharp-edged and clear to me. She is as she was in June of 1946. I am certain of this because it is the first time I've ever seen her wear a casual summer dress. She, like everyone else after the war, is changing. Clothes are changing. Later this year, the bikini will be invented by Louis Rayard, a French engineer. And as I stare at Ruth, I notice a sinuous beauty in the muscles of her arms. Her skin is a smooth walnut hue, from the week she'd just spent at the beach with her parents. Her father had taken the family to the Outer Banks to celebrate his official hiring at Duke. He had interviewed at a number of different places, including a small experimental art college in the mountains, but he felt most at home among the Gothic buildings at Duke. He would be teaching again that fall, a bright spot in what had otherwise been a difficult year of mourning. Things had changed between Ruth and me since that night in the park. Ruth had said little about my revelation, but when I walked her home, I didn't try to kiss her goodnight. I knew she was reeling, and even she would later admit that she was not herself for the next few weeks. The next time I saw her, she was no longer wearing her engagement ring, but I didn't blame her for this. She was in shock. But she was also rightfully angry that I had not trusted her with the information until that night. Coming on the heels of the loss of her family in Vienna, it was undoubtedly a terrible blow. For it is one thing to declare one's love for someone and quite another to accept that loving that person requires sacrificing one's dreams, and having children, creating a family, so to speak,
had taken on an entirely new significance for her in the wake of her family's losses. I understood this intuitively, and for the next couple of months neither of us pressed the other. We didn't speak of commitment, but we continued to see each other casually, perhaps two or three times a week. Sometimes I would take her to see a show or bring her to dinner. Other times we would stroll downtown. There was an art gallery of which she'd grown particularly fond, and we visited regularly. Most of the artwork was unmemorable, either in subject or in execution, but every now and then Ruth would see something special in a painting that I could not. Like her father, she was most passionate about modern art, a movement given birth to by painters like Van Gogh, Cézanne, and Gauguin. And she was quick to discern the influence of these painters in even the mediocre work we examined. These visits to the gallery and her deep knowledge of art in general opened up a world entirely foreign to me. However, I sometimes wondered whether our discussions about art became a means of avoiding conversation about our future. These discussions created a distance between us. But I was content to keep them going, longing even in those moments for both a forgiveness of the past and an acceptance of some kind of future for us, whatever that might be. Ruth, however, seemed no closer to a decision than she'd been on that fateful night in the park. She wasn't cold to me, but she hadn't invited greater intimacy either, and thus I was surprised when her parents invited me to spend part of their holiday at the beach with them. A couple of weeks of quiet walks on the beach together might have been just what we needed, but unfortunately it wasn't possible for me to be gone that long. With my father glued to the radio in the back room, I had by then become the face of the shop, and it was busier than ever. Veterans looking for work were coming in to buy suits they could barely afford in the hopes of finding a job. But companies were slow to hire, and when these desperate men walked in the store, I thought of Joe Torre and Bud Ramsey, and I did what I could for them. I convinced my father to stock lower-priced suits with fractional markups, and my mother did the alterations free of charge. Word of our reasonable prices had gotten out, and though we were no longer open on Saturdays, sales were increasing every month. Nonetheless, I was able to persuade my parents to lend me the car in order to visit Ruth's family toward the end of their vacation, and by Thursday morning I was on the road. It was a long drive, the last hour of which was spent driving on the sand itself. There was a wild, untamed beauty to the Outer Banks in the years right after the war. Largely cut off from the rest of the state, it was populated by families who'd lived there for generations, making their living from the sea. Sawgrass speckled the wind-blown dunes, and the trees looked like the twisted clay creations of a child. Here and there I saw wild horses, their heads sometimes rising as I passed, tails swishing to keep the flies at bay. With the ocean roaring on one side and the wind-swept dunes on the other, I rolled down the windows, taking it all in, and wondering what I might find when I reached my destination. When I finally pulled onto the sandy gravel drive, it was nearly sunset. I was surprised to see Ruth waiting for me on the front porch, barefoot, and wearing the same dress she is wearing now. I stepped out of the car, and as I stared at her, all I could think was how radiant she looked. Her hair fell loosely around her shoulders, and her smile seemed to hold a secret meant only for the two of us. When she waved at me, my breath caught at the sight of a tiny diamond flashing in the rays of the setting sun, my engagement ring, absent all these past months. I stood momentarily frozen, but she skipped down the steps and across the sand as if she hadn't a care in the world. When she jumped into my arms, she smelled of salt and brine and the wind itself, a scent I have forever associated with her and that particular weekend. I pulled her close, savoring the feel of her body against my own, thinking how much I'd missed holding her for the past 3 years.
"I am glad you are here," she whispered into my ear.
And after a long and gratifying embrace, I kissed her while the sound of ocean waves seemed to roar their approval. When she kissed me back, I knew instantly that she'd made her decision about me, and my world shifted on its axis. It was not the first kiss we'd ever shared, but in many ways it has become my favorite, if only because it happened when I needed it most, marking the beginning of one of the two most wonderful and life-altering periods of my life. Ruth smiles at me in the car, beautiful and serene in that summer dress. The tip of her nose is slightly red, her hair windblown and redolent of the ocean breeze.
"I like this memory," she says to me.
"I like it too," I say.
"Yes, because I was a young woman then. Thick hair, no wrinkles, nothing sagging."
"You haven't changed a bit." "Unsinn," she says with a dismissive wave. "I changed. I became old. And it is not fun to be old. Things that were once simple became difficult."
"You sound like me,"
I remark, and she shrugs, untroubled by the revelation that she is nothing but a figment of my imagination. Instead, she circles back to the memory of my visit.
"I was so happy that you were able to come on holiday with us.
I regret that my visit was so short." It takes her a moment to respond.
"I think," she says, "that it was good for me to have a couple of weeks of quiet time alone. My parents seem to know this too. There was little to do other than sit on the porch and walk in the sand and sip a glass of wine while the sun went down. I had much time to think about me, about us."
"Which is why you threw yourself at me when I showed up," I tease.
"I did not throw myself at you," she says indignantly. "Your memory is distorted. I walked down the steps and offered a hug. I was raised to be a lady. I simply greeted you. This embellishment is a product of your imagination."
"Maybe. Or maybe not. Who can know after so long? But I suppose it doesn't matter."
"Do you remember what we did next?" she asks. Part of me wonders if she is testing me.
"Of course," I answer. "We went inside and I greeted your parents. Your mother was slicing tomatoes in the kitchen and your father was grilling tuna on the back porch. He told me that he'd bought it that afternoon from a fisherman tying up at the pier. He was very proud of that. He seemed different as he stood over the grill that evening. Relaxed."
"It was a good summer for him," Ruth agrees. "By then he was managing the factory, so the days were not so hard on him. And it was the first time in years that we had enough money to go on holiday. Most of all, he was ecstatic at the thought of teaching again."
"And your mother was happy."
"My father's good spirits were infectious."
Ruth pauses for a moment.
"And like me, she had grown to like it here.
Greensboro would never be Vienna, but she had learned the language and made some friends. She had also grown to appreciate the warmth and generosity of the people here. In a way, I think she had finally begun to think of North Carolina as her home." Outside the car, the wind blows clumps of snow from the branches. None of them hits the car, but somehow it is enough to remind me again of exactly where I am. But it does not matter, not right now. "Do you remember how clear the sky was when we ate dinner?" I say. "There were so many stars."
That is because it was so dark. No lights from the city. My father noted the same thing.
I've always loved the Outer Banks. We should have gone every year, I say.
I think it would have lost its magic if we went every year, she responds. Every few years was perfect, like we did. Because every time we went back, it felt new and untamed and fresh again. Besides, when would we have gone?
We were always traveling in the summers. New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, even California. And always, Black Mountain. We had the chance to see this country in a way that most people never could. And what could be better?
Nothing, I think to myself, knowing in my heart that she is right.
My home is filled with keepsakes from those trips. Strangely, though, aside from a seashell we found the following morning, I had nothing to remind me of this place. And yet the memory never dimmed. I always enjoyed having dinner with your parents. Your father seemed to know something about everything.
He did, she says. His father had been a teacher. His brother was a teacher. His uncles were teachers. My father came from a family of scholars. But you were interesting to my father, too. He was fascinated by your work as a navigator during the war, despite your reluctance to speak of it. I think it increased his respect for you.
But your mother felt differently.
Ruth pauses, and I know she is trying to choose her words carefully. She toys with a wind-blown strand of hair, inspecting it before going on.
At that time, she was still worried about me. All she knew was that you had broken my heart only a few months earlier, and that even though we were seeing each other again, there was still something troubling me.
Ruth was talking about the consequences of my bout with mumps, and what it would likely mean for our future.
It was something she would tell her mother only years later when her mother's puzzlement turned to sadness and anxiety over the fact that she hadn't become a grandmother. Ruth gently revealed that we couldn't have children, careful not to place the blame entirely on me, though she could easily have done so. Another of her kindnesses, for which I've always been thankful.
She didn't say much at dinner, but afterwards I was relieved that she smiled at me.
She appreciated the fact that you offered to do the dishes.
It was the least I could do. To this day, that was the best meal I've ever had.
It was good, yes? Ruth reminisces. Earlier, my mother had found a roadside stand with fresh vegetables, and she had baked bread. My father turned out to be a natural with the grill.
And after we finished the dishes, we went for a walk.
Yes, she says. You were very bold that night.
I wasn't acting bold. I simply asked for a bottle of wine and a pair of glasses.
Yes, but this was new for you. My mother had never seen that side of you. It made her nervous.
But we were adults.
That was the problem.
You were a man, and she knew that men have urges. And women don't?
Yes, of course. But unlike men, women are not controlled by their urges. Women are civilized.
Did your mother tell you that?
My voice is skeptical. I did not need my mother to tell me. It was clear to me what you wanted. Your eyes were full of lust.
If I recall correctly, I say with crisp propriety, I was a perfect gentleman that night.
Yes, but it was still exciting for me, watching you try to control your urges, especially when you spread your jacket and we sat in the sand and drank the wine. The ocean seemed to absorb the moonlight, and I could feel that you wanted me, even if you were trying not to show it. You put your arm around me, and we talked and kissed and talked some more, and I was a little tipsy.
And it was perfect, I finally offer.
Yes, she agrees. It was perfect. Her expression is nostalgic and a little sad. I knew I wanted to marry you, and I knew for certain we would always be happy together. I pause, fully aware of what she was thinking even then. You were still hopeful that the doctor might be wrong. I think that I said that whatever happened would be in God's hands. That's the same thing, isn't it? Maybe, she answers, then shakes her head. What I do know is that when I was sitting with you that night, I felt like God was telling me that I was doing the right thing.
And then we saw the shooting star.
It blazed all the way across the sky, she says. Her voice even now is filled with wonder. It was the first time I had ever seen one like that.
I told you to make a wish, I said.
I did, she says, meeting my eyes. And my wish came true, only a few hours later.
Though it was late by the time Ruth and I got back to the house, her mother was still awake. She sat reading near the window, and as soon as we walked in the door, I felt her eyes sweep over us, looking for an untucked or improperly buttoned shirt, sand in our hair. Her relief was apparent as she rose to greet us, though she did her best to disguise it. She chatted with Ruth while I went back to the car to retrieve my suitcase. Like many of the cottages along this stretch of the beach, the house had two floors. Ruth and her parents had rooms on the lower level, while the room Ruth's mother showed me to was directly off the kitchen on the main floor. The three of us spent a few minutes visiting in the kitchen before Ruth began to yawn. Her mother began to yawn as well, signaling the end of the evening. Ruth did not kiss me in front of her mother. At that point, it wasn't something we'd yet done. And after Ruth wandered off, her mother soon followed. I turned out the lights and retreated to the back porch, soothed by the moonlit water and the breeze in my hair. I sat outside for a long time as the temperature cooled, my thoughts wandering from Ruth and me to Joe Torre to my parents. I tried to imagine my father and mother in a place like this, but I couldn't. Never once had we gone on vacation. The shop had always anchored us in place. But even if it had been possible, it wouldn't have been a holiday like this. I could no more imagine my father grilling with a glass of wine in hand than I could imagine him atop Mount Everest. And somehow the thought made me sad. My father, I realized, had no idea how to relax. He seemed to lead his life preoccupied by work and worry. Ruth's parents, on the other hand, seemed to enjoy each moment for what it was. I was struck by how differently Ruth and her parents reacted to the war. While my mother and father seemed to recede into the past, albeit in different ways, her parents embraced the future, as though seizing hold of their chance at life. They opted to make the most of their fortunate fates and never lost the sense of gratitude for what they had. The house was silent when I finally came in. Tempted by the thought of Ruth, I tiptoed down the stairs. There was a room on either side of the hallway, but because the doors were closed, I did not know which was Ruth's. I stood waiting, looking from one to the other. Then finally turned around and went back the way I'd come. Once in my room, I undressed and crawled into bed. Moonlight streamed through the windows, turning the room silver. I could hear the rolling sound of the waves, soothing in its monotony. And after a few minutes, I felt myself drifting off. Sometime later, and though I thought at first that I was imagining it, I heard the door open. I had always been a light sleeper, even more so since the war. And though only shadows were visible at first,
I knew it was Ruth. Disoriented, I sat up in the bed as she stepped into the room, closing the door quietly behind her. She was wearing a robe, and as she approached the bed, she undid the knot in a single fluid motion, and the robe slipped to the floor. A moment later, she was in the bed. As she slid toward me, her skin seemed to radiate a crackling electricity. Our mouths came together, and I felt her tongue push against my own as my fingers traced through her hair and down her back. We knew enough not to make a sound, the silence making everything even more exciting, and I rolled her onto her back. I kissed her cheek and trailed feverish kisses across and down her neck and then back to her mouth, lost in her beauty and in the moment. We made love, then made love again an hour later. In between, I spooned her against my body, whispering into her ear how much I loved her and that there would never be another. Through it all, Ruth said little, but in her eyes and her touch, I felt the echo of my words. Just before dawn, she kissed me tenderly and slipped back into her robe. As she opened the door, she turned to face me. "I love you too, Ira," she whispered. And with that, she was gone. I lay in bed awake until the sky began to lighten, reliving the hours we'd just spent together. I wondered whether Ruth was sleeping or whether she too was lying awake. I wondered whether she was thinking of me. Through the window, I watched the sun rise as if being heaved from the ocean, and in all my life I have never witnessed a more spectacular dawn. I did not leave my room when I heard low voices in the kitchen, her parents trying not to wake me. Finally, I heard Ruth come into the kitchen, and still I waited for a little while before putting on my clothes and opening the door. Ruth's mother stood at the counter pouring a cup of coffee while Ruth and her father were at the table. Ruth's mother turned to me with a smile. "Sleep well?" I did my best not to look at Ruth, but from the corner of my eye I thought I saw the tiniest of smiles flash across her lips. "Like a dream," I answered.
Luke. At Knoxville's arena, where Luke had last ridden 6 years ago, the bleachers were already nearly full. Luke was in the chute, experiencing the familiar rush of adrenaline, the world suddenly compressed. Only vaguely could he hear the announcer laying out the highs and lows of his career, even when the crowd grew silent. Luke didn't feel ready. His hands had trembled earlier, and he could feel the fear bubbling up, making it hard to concentrate. Beneath him, a bull named Crosshairs thrashed and reared, forcing him to focus on the immediate. The rope beneath the bull was held taut by other cowboys, and Luke adjusted his wrap. It was the same suicide wrap he'd used for as long as he'd been riding, the one he'd used on Big Ugly Critter. As he finished adjusting the wrap, Crosshairs wedged his leg against the rails, leaning hard. The cowboys who'd helped tighten the rope pushed back against the bull. Crosshairs shifted, and Luke quickly jammed his leg into position. He oriented himself, and as soon as he was ready, he said simply, "Let's go." The chute gate swung open, and the bull lunged forward with a savage buck, his head plunging down, hind legs reaching for the sky. Luke worked on staying centered, his arm held out as Crosshairs began to spin to the left. Luke cut with him, anticipating the move, and the bull bucked again before suddenly shifting direction. That move Luke didn't anticipate, and he went off center, his balance shifting slightly, but even then he stayed on. His forearms strained as he tried to right himself, holding on with everything he had. Crosshairs bucked once more and began to spin again just as the buzzer sounded. Luke reached for the wrap, freeing himself in the same instant he leapt from the bull. He landed on all fours and got quickly to his feet, heading toward the arena fence without turning around. When he reached the top, Crosshairs was already on his way out of the arena. Luke took a seat on the rails, waiting for his score as the adrenaline slowly drained from his system. The crowd roared when it was announced that he'd scored an 81. Not good enough for the top four, but good enough to keep him in contention. Yet even after he'd recovered, he spent a few minutes unsure whether he'd be able to ride again, the fear coming back hard. The next bull sensed his tension, and in the second round he was tossed only halfway into the ride. While in the air, he felt a surge of panic. He landed on one knee and felt something twist sharply before he toppled to the side. He went dizzy for a second, but he was operating on instinct by then and again escaped without harm. His first score was barely enough to keep him in the top 15, and in the short go, the final round, he rode again, finishing 9th overall. Afterward, he didn't wait around. After texting his mom, he started the truck and peeled out of the parking lot, making it back to the ranch a little after 4 a.m. Seeing the lights on in the main house, he surmised that his mom had either risen early or, more likely, hadn't gone to bed. He texted her again after turning off the engine, not expecting a reply. As usual, he didn't get one. In the morning, after 2 hours of fitful sleep, Luke hobbled into the farmhouse just as his mom was finishing up at the stove. Eggs over medium, sausage links, and pancakes, the flavorful aroma filling the kitchen. "Hey, Mom," he said, reaching for a cup. He hid the limp as best he could as he moved to the coffee pot, thinking he'd end up needing a lot more than a cup or two to wash down the ibuprofen he clutched in his hand. His mom studied him as he poured. "You're hurt," she said, sounding less angry than he'd expected, more concerned. "It's not too bad," he said, leaning on the counter, trying not to wince. "My knee swelled up a bit on the drive home, that's all. It just needs to loosen up." She brought her lips together, obviously wondering whether she should believe him before finally nodding. "Okay," she said, and after shifting the frying pan to a cold burner, she enveloped him in a hug, the first in weeks. The embrace lasted a beat longer than usual, as if she were trying to make up for lost time. When she pulled back, he noticed the bags under her eyes, and he knew she was operating on as little sleep as he was. She patted him on the chest. "Go ahead and have a seat," she said. "I'll bring over your breakfast." He moved slowly, taking care not to spill his coffee. By the time he'd straightened his leg beneath the table in an attempt to get comfortable, his mom had set the plate in front of him. She put the coffee pot on the table, then took a seat beside him. Her plate had exactly half the amount of food she'd put on his. "I knew you'd be late getting in, so I went ahead and fed the animals and checked the cattle this morning." That she didn't admit to waiting up didn't surprise him, nor would she complain about it.
"Thanks," he said. "How many people came by yesterday?"
"Maybe 200, but it rained a while in the afternoon, so there'll probably be more people today."
"Do I need to restock?"
She nodded. "Jose got some of it done before he went home, but we probably need some more pumpkins." He ate a few bites in silence.
"I got thrown," he said. "That's how I hurt my knee. I landed wrong."
She tapped her fork against her plate. "I know," she said.
"How would you know?"
"Liz, the gal from the arena office, called," she said. "She gave me a rundown on your rides. She and I go back a long way, remember?" He hadn't expected that, and at first he wasn't sure what to say. Instead, he speared a piece of the sausage and chewed, eager to change the subject.
"Before I left, I mentioned that Sophia will be coming by, right?"
"For dinner," she said. "I was thinking of blueberry pie for dessert."
"You don't have to do that."
"I already did," she said, pointing with her fork toward the counter. In the corner beneath the cabinets, he spotted her favorite ceramic pie dish, rivulets of blueberry juice seared onto its sides.
"When did you do that?"
"Last night," she said. "I had some time after we finished up with the customers. Do you want me to toss together a stew?"
"No, that's okay," he said. "I was thinking I'd grill some steaks."
"So mashed potatoes then," she added, already thinking ahead. "And green beans. I'll make a salad, too."
"You don't have to do all that."
"Course I do. She's a guest. Besides, I've tried your mashed potatoes, and if you want her to come back, it's better if I make them." He grinned.
Only then did he realize that in addition to baking the pie, she'd tidied up around the kitchen. Probably the house as well.
Thanks, he said. But don't be too hard on her.
I'm not hard on anybody. And sit up straight when you're talking to me.
He laughed. I take it you've finally forgiven me, huh?
Not at all, she said. I'm still angry that you competed in those events, but I can't do anything about it now. And besides, the season's over. I figure you'll come to your senses before January. You might act dumb sometimes, but I'd like to think I raised you better than to act dumb all the time.
He said nothing, reluctant to start an argument. You'll like Sophia, he said, changing the subject.
I should think so, since she's the first girl you've ever invited over.
Angie used to come over.
She's married to someone else now. And besides, you were a kid. It doesn't count.
I wasn't a kid. I was a senior in high school.
Same thing.
He cut another piece of pancake and swirled it in the syrup. Even if I think you're wrong, I'm glad we're talking again.
She forked a piece of egg. Me too.
For Luke, the rest of the day took on a strange cast. Ordinarily, after breakfast, he'd immediately start work, doing his best to cross items off the to-do list and always prioritizing. Some things had to be taken care of immediately, like getting the pumpkins ready before the customers started rolling in, or checking on an injured animal. As a rule, time passed quickly. He'd move from one project to the next, and before he knew it, it would be time for a quick lunch. The same thing would happen in the afternoons. Most days, feeling a little frustrated that he hadn't quite finished a given task, he'd find himself walking into the farmhouse just as dinner was about to be served, wondering how the hours had escaped him. Today promised to be no different, and as his mom had predicted, it was even busier than it had been on Saturday. Cars and trucks and minivans lined both sides of the drive, nearly back to the main road, and kids were everywhere. Despite the lingering soreness in his knee, he carried pumpkins, helped parents locate their kids in the maze, and filled hundreds of balloons with helium. The balloons were new this year, as were the hot dogs and chips and soda, at a table manned by his mom. But as he moved from one duty to the next, he would find himself thinking about Sophia. From time to time, he checked his watch, sure that hours had passed, only to realize it had been a mere 20 minutes. He wanted to see her again. He'd talked to her on the phone on Friday and Saturday, and each time he'd called her, he'd been nervous before she picked up. He knew how he felt about her. The problem was that he had no idea whether she felt the same way. Before dialing, he found it all too easy to imagine that she'd answer with only tepid enthusiasm. Even though she had been both cheerful and chatty, after hanging up, he'd replay the conversation, plagued by doubts about her true feelings. It was just about the oddest thing he'd ever experienced. He wasn't some giddy, obsessive teenager. He'd never been like that. And for the first time in his life, he wasn't sure what to do. All he really knew for certain was that he wanted to spend time with her, and that dinner couldn't come soon enough. 13. Sophia. You know what this means, right? Dinner with his mom, Marcia said. As she spoke, she was nibbling from a box of raisins, which Sophia knew would comprise her breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the day. Marcia, like a lot of girls in the house, either saved her calories for cocktails later, or made up for the extra cocktail calories from the night before. Sophia was fastening a clip in her hair, just about ready to go.
I think it means we're going to eat.
You're being evasive again, Marcia noted. You didn't even tell me what you two did on Thursday night.
I told you we changed our minds and went out for some Japanese food. And then we drove to the ranch.
Wow, she said. I can practically imagine the whole night unfolding in high detail.
What do you want me to say? Sophia said, exasperated.
I want details, specifics. And since you're so obviously trying not to tell me, I'm just going to assume that you two got hot and heavy.
Sophia finished with the clip. We didn't. Which makes me wonder why you're so interested.
Oh, gee, I don't know. Maybe because of the way you've been flitting around the room? Because when we went to the party on Friday night, you didn't even freak out when you saw Brian? And during the football game when your cowboy called, you wandered off to talk to him, even though the team was just about to score.
If you ask me, it seems like things are already getting serious. We met last weekend. It's not serious yet.
Marcia shook her head. No,
I'm not buying it. I think you like this guy a lot more than you're saying. But I should also warn you that it's probably not a good idea.
When Sophia turned toward her, Marcia dumped the last of the raisins into her palm and crumpled the box. She tossed it toward the garbage and missed, as usual.
You just came off a relationship. You're on the rebound. And rebound relationships never work, she said with complete assurance.
I'm not on the rebound. I broke up with Brian a long time ago.
It wasn't so long ago. And just so you know, he's still not over you. Even after what happened last weekend, he still wants you back.
So?
I'm just trying to remind you that Luke is the first guy you've gone out with since then. Which means that you haven't had time to figure out what it is you really want in a guy. You're still off kilter. Can't you remember the way you were acting last weekend? You freaked out because Brian showed up. And now, while in this emotional state, you've found someone else. That's what rebound means. And rebound relationships don't work because you're not in the right frame of mind. Luke isn't Brian, I get that. All I'm trying to say is that in a few months, you might want something more than simply, he's not Brian. And by then, if you're not careful, you'll get hurt. Or he will.
I'm just going to dinner, Sophia protested. It's not that big of a deal.
Marcia popped the last of the raisins into her mouth.
If you say so.
Sometimes Sophia hated her roommate. Like right now, while she was driving out to the ranch. She'd been in a good mood for the past 3 days, even enjoying the party and Friday's football game. Earlier today, she'd gotten a big chunk done on a paper for her Renaissance art class, which wasn't due until Tuesday. All in all, an excellent weekend. And then, just as she was getting ready to cap it off in just the right way, Marcia had to open her mouth and put all these crazy thoughts in her head. Because one thing she knew for sure was that she wasn't on the rebound.
Right?
The thing was, she wasn't simply over Brian, she was glad about it. Since last spring, the relationship had made her feel like Jacob Marley, the ghost in A Christmas Carol, who had to carry forever the chains he'd forged in life. After Brian had cheated the second time, part of her had checked out emotionally, even though she didn't end it right away. She'd still loved him, just not in the same blind, innocent, all-consuming way. Part of her had known he wouldn't change, and that feeling only grew stronger over the summer, and her instincts were proven right. By the time they'd broken up, it felt as if it had already been over for a long time. And yes, she admitted she'd been upset afterward. Who wouldn't be? They'd dated for almost 2 years. It would have been strange if she hadn't been upset. But she was far more upset by the other things he'd done. The calls, the texts, following her around campus. Why didn't Marcia understand that? Satisfied that she'd sorted through everything, Sophia approached the exit that would lead to the ranch, feeling a little better. Marcia didn't know what she was talking about. She was doing fine emotionally, and she wasn't on the rebound. Luke was a nice guy, and they were still getting to know each other. It wasn't like she was going to fall in love with him. It wasn't like the thought had even occurred to her. Right? As Sophia pulled up the drive, she was still trying to silence the irritating voice of her roommate, unsure whether she should park at Luke's or head on over to the farmhouse. It was already getting dark, and a thin layer of fog had drifted in. Despite her headlights, she had to lean over the wheel to see where she was going. She drove slowly, vaguely wondering if Dog would appear to direct her. Just then, she spotted him wandering into the road at the turnoff. Dog trotted ahead of the car, occasionally glancing over his shoulder until she reached Luke's bungalow. She pulled to a stop and parked in the same location she had before. Lights were blazing inside, and she saw Luke in the window, standing in what she thought might be the kitchen. By the time she'd shut off the engine and climbed out, Luke was stepping off the porch and walking toward her. He wore jeans and boots and a white collared shirt with the sleeves rolled halfway up, his hat nowhere in sight. She took a deep breath, steadying herself, wishing again she hadn't talked to Marcia. Despite the darkness, she could tell he was smiling.
"Hey there," he called out.
When he was close, he leaned in to kiss her, and she caught a whiff of shampoo and soap. It was short, just a kiss of greeting, but somehow he must have sensed her hesitation.
"Something's bothering you,"
he said. I'm okay, she demurred. She offered a quick smile but found it hard to look at him. He said nothing for a beat, then nodded.
All right, he said. I'm glad you're here.
Despite his unwavering gaze, she realized that she wasn't sure what he was thinking. Me too. He took a small step backward and tucked a hand in his pocket.
Did you get your paper written?
The distance made it easier for her to think. Not all of it, she answered. I got a good start, though. How did it go here?
Okay, he said. We sold most of the pumpkins. The only ones left are those that are better for pies, anyway.
She noticed, for the first time, a trace of remaining dampness in his hair. What will you do with those?
My mom will can them. And then for the rest of the year, she'll make the tastiest pies and pumpkin bread in the world. Sounds like it could be another business. Not a chance. Not because she couldn't, but because she'd hate being in the kitchen all day. She's kind of an outdoor person.
I guess she'd have to be. For a moment, neither of them said anything, and for the first time since she'd met him, the silence felt awkward.
You ready? He asked, motioning toward the farmhouse. I got the charcoal going just a few minutes ago.
I'm ready, she said. As they walked, she wondered if he would reach for her hand, but he didn't. Instead, he left her alone with her thoughts as they rounded the grove of trees. The fog continued to thicken, especially in the distance, the pastures entirely hidden from view. The barn was nothing but a shadow, and the farmhouse, with its lights beckoning in the windows, resembled a glowing jack-o'-lantern. She could hear the crunch of gravel beneath her feet. I just realized you never told me your mom's name. Should I call her Mrs. Collins?
The question seemed to stump him. I don't know. I just call her Mom.
What's her first name?
Linda.
Sophia mentally tried them out. I think Mrs. Collins, she said, since it's my first time meeting her. I want her to like me. He turned, and surprising her, she felt him take her hand in his.
She'll like you.
Before they'd even had time to close the kitchen door, Linda Collins turned off the mixer and looked first to Luke, then scrutinized Sophia before turning back to Luke again. She set the mixer on the counter, the blades coated with mashed potatoes, and wiped her hands on her apron. As Luke had predicted, she was dressed in jeans and a short-sleeved shirt, though the boots had been replaced with walking shoes. Her graying hair was pulled back in a loose ponytail.
So this is the young woman you've been hiding, huh?
She opened her arms, offering Sophia a quick hug.
It's nice to meet you. Call me Linda.
Her face showed the effects of years spent working in the sun, though her skin was less weather-beaten than Sophia had expected. There was an underlying strength to her embrace, the kind of muscle tone that came from hard work.
Nice to meet you. I'm Sophia.
Linda smiled.
I'm glad Luke finally decided to bring you over to say hello. For a while there, I couldn't help but think he was embarrassed about his old mom.
You know that's not true,
Luke said, and his mom winked before moving to hug him as well.
Why don't you get the steaks going? They're marinating in the fridge, and it'll give Sophia and me a chance to get to know each other.
All right. But remember that you promised to go easy on her.
Linda couldn't hide the mirth in her expression.
I honestly don't know why he'd say such a thing. I'm a nice person. Can I get you something to drink? I made some sun tea this afternoon.
That would be great, Sophia said.
Thanks.
Luke flashed her a good luck expression before retreating to the porch, while Linda poured a glass of tea and handed it to Sophia. Her own glass was on the counter, and she moved back to the stove where she twisted open a jar of green beans that Sophia guessed had come from the garden. Linda put them in the pan with salt and pepper along with butter.
Luke said that you go to Wake Forest?
I'm a senior there.
Where are you from?
She asked, turning the burner on low.
I take it you're not from around here.
She'd asked in exactly the same way Luke had on the night they'd met, curious but not judgmental. Sophia responded by filling Linda in on the whos, whats, wheres, and whens in her life, though only in broad strokes. At the same time, Linda shared some details about life on the ranch, and the conversation flowed as easily as it had with Luke. From what Linda described, it was clear that she and Luke were interchangeable when it came to chores. Both could do it all, although Linda mostly handled the bookkeeping and cooking while Luke did a bit more of the outdoor work and mechanical repairs, more out of preference than anything else. By the time she'd finished cooking, Linda motioned toward the table just as Luke returned. He poured himself a glass of tea and went back outside to finish the steaks.
There have been times when I wished I had gone to college, Linda went on. Or if not that, at least had taken some classes.
What would you have studied? Accounting? Maybe some classes in agriculture or cattle management? I had to teach myself, and I made a lot of mistakes.
You seem to be doing okay, Sophia observed.
Linda said nothing, merely reached for her glass and took another drink.
You said you had younger sisters?
3, Sophia said.
How old are they?
19 and 17.
Twins?
My mother tells me that she was happy with 2, but my dad really wanted a boy, so they tried one more time. She swears she almost had a heart attack in the doctor's office when she heard the news.
Linda reached for her tea. I'll bet it was fun growing up with so many of you in the house.
Actually, it was an apartment. It still is. But it was fun, even if it was a little cramped at times. I miss sharing a room with my sister Alexandra. We slept in the same room until I went off to college.
So you're close.
We are, Sophia admitted.
Linda studied her in the acute way that Luke often did.
But?
But it's different now. They're still my family and will always be close, but things changed when I left the state to come to Wake. Alexandra, even though she goes to Rutgers, still gets home every other weekend or so, sometimes more. And Branka and Delena are living in the house and going to high school and working at the deli. Meanwhile, I'm down here 8 months a year. In the summers, just when it begins to feel like things are getting back to normal, it's time for me to leave again.
She ran her nail over the scuffed wooden table.
The thing is, I don't know what I can do to fit in again. I graduate in a few months, and unless I end up with a job in New York or New Jersey, I don't know how often I'll get back home. And what's going to happen then?
Sophia could feel Linda's eyes on her, and she realized that it was the first time she'd ever shared those thoughts out loud. She wasn't sure why. Maybe because the conversation with Marcia had left her feeling off balance, or maybe it was because Linda seemed like someone she could trust. As she said the words, though, she suddenly realized she'd wanted to say them for a long time to someone who would understand. Linda leaned forward and patted the top of her hand.
It's hard, but keep in mind that it happens to almost every family. Kids move away from their parents. Brothers and sisters drift apart because life gets in the way. But then often, after a while, they get closer again. The same thing happened to Drake and his brother.
Drake? My late husband, she said. Luke's father.
He and his brother were close, and then when Drake went on the circuit, they barely talked for years. Later, though, after Drake retired, they started growing close again.
That's the difference between family and friends. Family is always there, no matter what, even when it's not right next door.
Which means that you'll find a way to keep the connection alive, especially since you realize how important it is.
I do, Sophia said.
Linda sighed. I always wanted brothers and sisters, she confessed.
I always thought it would be fun, having someone to play with, someone to talk to. I used to ask my mom about it all the time, and she'd just say, we'll see. What I didn't know until I was older was that my mom had a series of miscarriages, and her voice faltered before she went on. She just couldn't have any more. Sometimes things just don't work out the way you want them to.
As she said it, Sophia had the distinct feeling that Linda might have suffered some miscarriages as well. As soon as she realized it, however, Linda slid her chair back, obviously ending the subject.
I'm going to cut up some tomatoes for the salad, she announced. The steaks should be ready any minute.
Do you need some help?
You can help me set the table, she agreed. The plates are there, and utensils are in the drawer over there, she said, pointing.
Sophia retrieved them and finished setting the table. Linda diced tomatoes and cucumbers and shredded the lettuce, then tossed everything together in a brightly colored bowl just as Luke returned with the steaks.
We need to let these sit for a couple of minutes, Luke said, putting the platter of steaks on the table.
Perfect timing, his mom said. Let me just get the beans and potatoes in bowls and dinner will be ready.
Luke took a seat.
So what were y'all talking about in here? From outside, I got the sense that you two were knee-deep in serious conversation.
We were talking about you, his mom said, turning around, a bowl in each hand.
I hope not, he said. I'm not that fascinating.
There's always hope, his mom quipped, making Sophia laugh.
Dinner passed easily, punctuated by laughter and stories.
Sophia told them about some of the antics that went on at the sorority house, including the fact that the plumbing had to be replaced because too many girls were bulimic, which corroded the pipes. And Luke told a few stories about some of the more colorful events on tour, one of which included a friend.